You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now is Harry Richardson. He's a writer, including books, The Story of Muhammad and Anglophobia, and he's also the president of the British Australian community, all the way from Queensland. Harry, how are you? Good morning.
Very good and welcome, Marie. Really nice to be here.
It's very nice to have you with us this morning. Okay, Harry, riddle me this. What does it mean to be British?
Oh, we're going to start with a big one. Well, I suppose race is a little bit of a fuzzy thing. Ethnicity is also fuzzy. For myself, my cousin did some research and traced our ancestors back into the 1700s. Everyone was British. I suspect if you went back, most of them would have gone back. You know, if you could go back far enough, they would all go back quite a long way. There were waves of migration of Vikings, Romans, and so forth. But the people of the British Isles have, for the most part, have been there for a long time. We have a shared heritage, okay? So we have a belief in shared heritage. Like, I can look at you and say, well, you look like if I went back far enough, we'd probably share some ancestors, okay? If I had someone from Japan, I mean, eventually there's probably shared ancestors in Africa or something, but I mean, it would be so far back. So it's really a belief in shared heritage, and it's an identity that we feel. So I feel British, you know, I feel English, and I have an empathy. I mean, I have an empathy with all of the human race, but I have a particular empathy with my own people, which I consider British. I'd have an empathy with my own city, which was Manchester. If Manchester United were playing Liverpool, I'd probably be supporting Manchester United. And I have an even stronger empathy with my immediate family, especially my children. So we have these rings of attraction, almost of bonding with different groups. We're a group animal. We're not like cats. We're more like a dog or a lion, you know, that live in prides or groups. Originally, the first groups were very small, like extended family groups. Then they grew into, they had what they call the big man tradition, where you have a big man of the group. And then that expanded into tribes and eventually out into nation states, which Britain was one of the very first, actually. There's very few nations around today which were actually nations 100 years ago. Britain's been a nation really or England's been a nation for a long time. I think we've got like 1,000 years. So we would be one of the oldest nations. Our island geography, I think, has been a big help with that. But so being English or British is being part of the British Isles. Obviously, there's been friction like everywhere. Everyone has the English and the French, or you go to the Thais and the Burmese, or the Japanese, Chinese, everyone has their own friction. So the Scottish and the Welsh and the English. When we go abroad, we're a little more congenial with each other, I suppose. And over time, these things have faded a little bit. But yeah, so that to me is British. I have an identity. And this is often a background thing, but when things go wrong or in times of trouble, then that sort of thing comes to the foreground. It's like, for instance, Yugoslavia. You know, Yugoslavia existed when I was younger. Yugoslavia was a place on the map, and it was a country, but the people there had their own little identities. There was the Serbs, there was the Croats, there was the Muslims. And then when things broke up and went south, all of a sudden these guys are shooting at each other. And the Serbs are protecting the Serbs, and the Croats are protecting the Croats, and so on and so forth. So identity is important. I believe it's important. It's an important part of who you are, who I am, who you are, who everybody is. All humans, we have an identity. You know, when you talk to people here, you might talk to someone on the street and say, that in Australia, they have an Australian passport, but they might be Chinese Australian. And you say, are you an Australian? And they're like, no, I'm Chinese. Like me, when I got my passport, you know, people would say, I joke and say, oh, I'm an Aussie now, and I'd wave my passport and laugh, and everyone would laugh, you know. Of course, you're not an Aussie, you're English, you know. No, I'm assimilating into Australia. I love Australia. I would fight and die for Australia, actually. But I still have, my heart is still English. I have an identity there. And it's important to me. Not wildly important. I'm not one of these people who shaves his head and tattoos a Union Jack on it or anything. But I'm English. And that means something to me. And I see other people who might be Indian, and that means something to them. And I respect that. I mean, good on you. You have your people. I have my people. Of course, this is completely natural. It's completely normal for people to have an identity, outside of simply the family identity. So, yeah.
So patriotism has been under attack, particularly due to critical theorists and critical race theory, especially in the last 10, latterly in the last 5 years. So why is it then that you have the poor Brits, as you said, you've got a history in the British Isles that goes back thousands of years. In critical race theory, you're not allowed, the one time you're not a colonizer is at home. So then all of a sudden, you're not allowed to defend your Britishness on your own soil whilst everybody else is criticized for wanting to, like we look here in New Zealand, and you would see this in Australia too, is that those who are resident first want to defend their nationality, sovereignty over the land that they're on, but you're not allowed to do that in the UK. Do you sense a frustration from a lot of Brits around that?
I think people are starting to wake up now. This to me, I've been onto this for a long time. And it's like you say, patriotism's under attack. Well, not really. Indians are not under attack for being patriotic. Chinese are not under attack. Black South Africans are not under attack for being patriotic. That it's like no one criticized Nelson Mandela or Gandhi for being patriotic and fighting for their people. The only people who are singled out are white European Christians. There's an unspoken assumption that we are not entitled, or we're not allowed at any point to have. It's really we're not supposed to have our own country that we can call our own and be like a super majority in that country, which previously our countries were actually very homogenous, even compared to others, particularly the UK. I mean, and the BBC will dispute this and pretend that Roman Britain was full of sub-Saharan Africans. It wasn't. Even in my childhood, to see people of African heritage, which would mostly be West Indians, Jamaicans, was very rare. You get the occasional bus keeper, bus conductor. Where I lived, it was very rare to have people. There was the odd in a few Indians starting to come in. Prior to World War II, it would have been vanishingly small. Maybe in London. I mean, Gandhi studied in England. There were central London. There would have been and
Well, there
maybe.
were always connections via empire, weren't there?
Yeah, of course,
So,
of course, of course. But
I
in that.
mean, Māori travelled to visit Victoria. She was very open to receive chiefs and dignitaries from New Zealand tribes,
Yes,
and
absolutely.
she did on a regular basis, as did her predecessors. So there was always, visitation. But that's the thing. There was always this connection with empire, and then, of course, empire dissolved into Commonwealth through the 40s, post Second World War. The Commonwealth in itself was pretty strong. And then we've now seen these sort of Republican movements and things in the Commonwealth start to dissolve. And we certainly see this here in this country. I think of Jacinda Ardern, who, away we would have left the Commonwealth, and she didn't quite get that ticked off the to-do list. So there's always been an acceptance, I think, amongst Britain, like a family, a British extended family, and that's now been eroded. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think that was partly one of our problems was empire, because the British, I mean, were in back in the day, were very proud of their empire. They had this huge empire, and there was some financial benefit. I'm not quite sure how much, but I think it was less than people expect. It's like, it wasn't like they conquered the country, like the Spanish conquered South America and just looted gold and silver. The English didn't always do that. I think Australia was one of the most profitable countries that they had, and then partly from the gold rush, but the various things in maintaining the empire, they sort of they had this a big thing was open trade. So, and they had open trade, they had freedom of movement. They were really the first globalists. I mean, the British Empire was, what they say, the sun never set, and they tried to keep this very open. There's people like Rhodes, Cecil Rhodes, who was really obsessed with the British Empire. And I think that they made a lot of concessions due to this. Like, for instance, when the Australians broke away from the UK, from Britain in 1901 and the secession, one of the reasons was that they wanted to have, the main real, really, one of the main motivations was the desire to have what people refer to as the White Australia policy. The reason they had to break away because Britain didn't want to allow this. And one of the major protagonists against this was Japan, of all people. It's like the Japanese fought tooth and nail to stop the Australia in from like 1890s, or maybe before, maybe 1860s. They fought tooth and nail to stop Australia having a restrictive immigration policy, or at least for themselves. Their reasoning was that they said, well, we understand that you don't want to allow Chinese in or Africans, but you can't put us in the same bucket with Chinese and Africans. We're different. We're on a par with the Europeans. So you must give us open slather. Now, to be fair to them, they weren't trying to swamp Australia with people. They didn't want a lot of people to move, but they wanted the right to be allowed to travel to Australia because they wanted to be put on a peg with Europeans. So they were demanding that Australia have an open border for Japanese, which was a little hypocritical because since then, I mean, even today, like I would not be able to go and get citizenship in Japan. It's almost still almost
It's
completely
one
lost.
of the most restrictive countries in the world, and it's your countries in the world, yeah.
Yeah, and good on them. But back in the day, they fought tooth and nail. And what they did was they lobbied the British government, and they were the British government was trying to enact treaties with them on trade and also on a naval treaty. Because at that time, it was 1904, the Japanese Navy defeated the Russians, which everyone nearly fell over when that happened. It was like, oh my God, it's the first, I think it was the first time in recent times that a non-European power destroyed a European navy. So the British were trying to do a naval treaty. And so they were telling the Australians, look, you can't put this, you can't restrict them. You can't restrict them. So what they actually did was they brought in a dictation test, which was based on the South Africans had done a similar thing, and so they copied this, where they said, "Okay, yes, you can come to Australia, but you have to pass a dictation test, and it won't just be in English; it can be in any European language." So, if a Japanese person tried to come in, they just give them a dictation test in Hungarian or something, which they wouldn't pass. So they did it not explicitly, but implicitly. But the British were desperately trying to have this really open world where people and goods could move around. Now, at the time, the movement of things moved around in sailboats and maybe later on, maybe steamships, you know. So mass transport was far less than it is today. You know, like most people, I just don't think that they envisioned millions of Indians or Chinese moving to England or to New Zealand or Australia. Since World War II, communications have just, you know, exploded in their efficiency and cheapness, and that became a thing. And I think the English passed shortly after World War II passed a law. I'm not quite sure why they passed it. I have suspicions that there could have been malignant groups that pushed it, but I don't know that. This is just a suspicion. And they passed a law saying that anyone in the Commonwealth could come and reside in the UK. This was never reciprocated. For me to get a citizenship in India was almost impossible. I remember at the end of the war, as a gentleman called Enoch Powell, who was quite famous as a very nationally a patriotic nationalistic person, he went to India in the war and absolutely loved it. He spoke two or three Indian languages. He was a linguist. He spoke 12 languages before he died. He was incredible, incredible academic. And he desperately wanted to stay on in India in the Indian army. He was a captain in the army, and he said, no, you've got to go, because you're whites. We're not having any whites in our army. And meanwhile, the English were passing a law saying, well, anyone from India can come and live here. As soon as you come here, just give you a passport, which was really, I think it was just partly this culture and tradition of having really open sort of borders for trade, which had been very successful for them. You know, they weren't necessarily marauding in the way that the Spanish and the Portuguese had done in South America, although the English had marauded the ships coming back, to be fair. But most of our colonies and the like, such as New Zealand, we didn't come to New Zealand and take, what was it to take in New Zealand? I mean,
we send a lot of wool and meat, but our primary export to the UK actually was our people.
So where did the wool and meat come from? Well, they had to bring sheep and breed sheep and cows, and then build factories that made butter and so forth. So it was they enriched the areas and traded with them, you know. So there was a genuine addition to most places that they went to. They improved a lot of places. They bought railways, they bought communications and so forth.
Douglas Murray talks about it in his book, The War on the West, in a convenient rewriting of history. When it comes to Britishness and Englishness, that people seem to forget that it was the Brits that pretty much abolished slavery. That's a very convenient thing to get, particularly within the American context. For someone like yourself, I mean, you're doing this work in terms of just helping people sort of remember the history and the positives and trying to actually protect your own sovereign Britishness. How do you then respond to those, particularly the progressives or the critical theorists, who now seem to have the ear of the media and the government, depending on which party that you're at, shutting down debate and labelling anyone, someone like you, for example, with your work that you've done, with the books that you've written, as a racist and white supremacist? What do you say to those people?
Well, surprisingly, very few people actually attack me like that. You know, it's always surprised me. When I wrote my first book on Islam, people said, "Well, how many death threats have you had?" I said, "I haven't had any threats." You know, with Anglophobia, it was, it was published in Quadrant, which is a really high quality Australian magazine. You know, in the first edition, it was split into four parts, and the first part, the lead article was by Tony Abbott, who was a former prime minister. So it's a really high quality publication, and there's some really stuff that would really be condemned. You know, we go into some pretty hardcore stuff that would normally set the left off like a, you know, like a, it'd trigger them like nothing else, and all we got really was silence. So I think, to an extent, it's sometimes the way that you do it. So we haven't been attacked, but if I was attacked and called a white supremacist, I'd just explain to them that, well, I'd ask them, why would you refer to me as a supremacist? A supremacist is someone who thinks that his religious or ethnic or racial group is supreme over everyone else. I've never said that. Look, even if English people were the worst group on the planet, you know, demonstrably, and you could show that, they're still my people. And I love them, you know. I love my people. I'm not obsessively, but you know, they're my people. I why wouldn't I like my people? There's other groups that I could point to and say, oh well, you guys don't do this well or you don't do that well. But I don't say, you know, so you shouldn't love your people. I mean, what that's bizarre. So and racist, well, define racist. I don't know. People, what does that word even mean?
Well, that's a very good question, because I mean the definition has been changed.
This is what I always say to people. If they say to me, you're a racist, the first thing I say is, well, define racist. What do you mean by that? Well, if they say, well, someone who prefers his own people over others, I say, well, yeah, okay, guilty. What we do, we compare it to your children. I mean, I don't know if you have any children. I have a daughter. If I was on a ship and the ship was going down and there was only one place in the lifeboat, I'd be fighting to get my daughter onto that lifeboat ahead of other people's children. Now, that's not because I hate other people's children. I like other people's children, but when push comes to shove, I'm going to prioritize my daughter. Okay, and there's no one would say to me, "Oh, you're a monster! What an immoral thing to do." Well, no, it's like that's a perfectly moral thing to do. Imagine not doing that, and then you finally survive. What would your daughter say to you? You know, hey, you were putting someone else's kid on that lifeboat. What the hell? Mm-hmm. So shouldn't I? Prioritize my own people? I mean, if a war broke out, would I, between, let's say, England and France, would I go and fight for the French? Well, why would I do that? You know, or fight for India, or fight? No, my loyalty lies with my people. You know, and this is, I mean, as I said, it's a fuzzy thing. I mean, why do I feel that they're my people? I grew up, we were a group of people who created an identity, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, you know, you can go and join a gang, and a gang is a group of people who've created an identity. a nation. The New Zealanders have created a nation, an identity, which is somewhat separate from the British identity. I mean, it's intertwined and connected. You know, when I, you know, someone said to me, imagine this Kiwi. I'd immediately imagine someone who's basically of British stock. You know, I wouldn't imagine an Indian person. But Kiwis, you know, when I think of a Kiwi, I know that when they talk, they're going to say six and they're going to say six. Oh, you know, that's a terrible accent. Identities are real. They mean things to people. They matter to people. And the critical race theorists and so forth admit this. They say, yes, absolutely. Identities are real. They're very important. I mean, they're more obsessed with identity probably than I am. Some of these people are fanatics. But the one identity that doesn't exist unless we're criticizing it is the white Europeans. You know, if you, we, you know, you're the white people, the idea of white people as an identity is real when we're criticizing you for having slaves or genociding Aborigines, which never happened, by the way, but yeah, they criticize you for this, then you're, you know, it's a real identity. But when you say, well, I'm a white person or I'm an English person, they're like, what does that even mean? There's no such thing. You don't even have a culture. You're not, it's not a real identity. It's like, well, hang on a minute. A moment ago when you were bagging me and bagging my people, it was an identity. But all of a sudden when I want to say something proud, and this is the way it works. And I feel the attack that we're under, most people don't recognize it. And I feel like it's a narcissistic type of an attack, which if you've ever seen people or even been in a relationship that's narcissistic, a narcissist attacks someone on a psychological level in a very clever way. They do it in a way that the person doesn't realize they're under attack. They make the person constantly feel like they've disappointed. It's like, oh my God, you look at the way you've dressed. Look at the house. It's a mess. Look at when you go out, how come you're talking to people all the time? How come you doing this? How come you doing that? And it's this constant criticism, which people end up feeling that everything's their fault. And the attacks on us are run in that way. You know, they run in it's like, and this is, you mentioned critical theory. Okay. What does critical theory say? I think who was it came up with that? It was one of the Frankfurt School, and they basically said, criticize everything. Don't, you know, never come up with solutions. Just criticize. Well, this is just pure narcissism, and this is what they've done. They've used their assets in media, government, schools, and they use it to constantly criticize. You know, as you said, you know, slavery. You had slaves. You know, it's like. They never say, well, okay, everyone else had slaves. And by the way, you abolished it. And by the way, England never had, there was never slavery in England. Slave ships, if they were in trouble, let's say the rudder broke and they had to pull into port in somewhere like Bristol, then all the slaves would be immediately released because it was illegal to have slaves in England. Now, the English did go out and participate in slavery, and probably due to their technological advantages, they had quite large slave holdings, but they certainly weren't the only ones. I mean, throughout history, slavery was very ubiquitous, but only the English get criticized for this. I mean, there's lots of slaves already still throughout the Middle East, throughout Asia, through Africa, and probably in England, well, definitely in England, that what they call grooming gangs were really a sexual slavery gang. In essence, you know. So it's really, this is the crux of it, is that we're under an attack, and it's a narcissistic attack. It's a psychological attack, which is designed to break down our belief in ourselves and make us feel guilty and blame ourselves for everything that's happened throughout history. Like, even if we weren't there, you know, like, even if our people weren't there, like, if the ancient Egyptians had slaves, it was somehow the fault of white Christian men, you know. It's like, it's just ludicrous, the limits that these people go to, you know. That's really the game, is like to break, and the goal, of course, with all narcissists, is domination and power, to take what you have. So, you know, with a spouse or whatever, or another person, they break them down so that they will do what they want. So they get the basically have a person that virtually is a slave, you know, doing whatever they want, acting how they want, controlling them, you know, giving them their resources. You know, if that person owns a house, they'll sign it over to them. And in our case, you know, we had a nation, and these people want what we've got. I mean, we're the wealthiest people in the world. We were until a short time ago. We were, you know, amongst, and we still are amongst the wealthiest societies on the planet. And they want this. You know, people, our enemies want this. They want control, and they want to take what we have. So they instead, they know that they can't invade us militarily. They're not strong enough to do that, even today. So what they're doing is using this narcissistic psychological attack to make us feel guilty and say, look, you've got no right to say that this is your country and that we can't come in. You must open your borders. You must allow us in. You must allow us to sign on for your social security. You must give us free medical care. You must, you know, allow my family to come in. You must, you know, you must pay reparations, you know, for slavery that, even though I wasn't a slave, and you know, California was never a state that had slaves. It was the USA, actually. Slavery was very limited in the USA. It was about around 2% of all the slaves who went to America, the Americas, went to the USA. It was mostly they went to South America or the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. And of the states, there was only, I believe, 6 states that had slavery. And if you look today at where are the wealthiest states, they're not the states that had slavery. So the idea that slavery was this bonanza of financial, you know, a goose that was laying golden eggs, it doesn't really stack up, you know. And South America had far more slaves, and the Caribbean had far more slaves. Well, which is more wealthy, America or the Caribbean or South America? Well, obviously, North America, you know, the US and Canada, which had no slaves, are wealthier, you know. Mm. So, you know, none of this stacks up. It's not based on facts or reason. It's just a narcissistic attack, and they just use it all the time to pummel people. And it's horrible. It's awful. And, you know, I see people who are the people, you know, this is what our goal is to wake people up and say, look, it's not your fault. This is a game that they're playing, and they're doing it to bash you down and take what you've gotten, and they're destroying you psychologically. And that's just, we have huge suicide rates. We have depression. We have, you know, deaths from drug overdoses and God knows what. I mean, our society is actually crumbling. And I believe that, you know, I mean, you know, there's lots of reasons, but one of the reasons is just this constant narcissistic abuse of our people. We're being told all the time from nowadays. I mean, I was lucky. When I went through school, I never suffered this. But my daughter comes back from school, you know, and she's like, over here we have things like this. This is what they call the stolen generation, which was, it's been blown out of proportion. Now, I don't know. I'm not an expert on stolen generation, but people claim that it was, you know, the whites were just riding into Aboriginal villages and stealing children. I mean, it was just nothing like that. It was the social services were taking at-risk children. Now, they probably, when social services take children, it's not always a great thing. But I think it was generally done with they did it when there was a belief that children were at risk. They did it with half-caste children, I think. I don't think they did it with full Aboriginal children. And they believed that they were bringing them into nicer homes and a better environment. Now, again, I'm sure there were some cases where the people with, you know, Aboriginal children were taken and probably ended up in abusive homes, and probably, you know, there's a good chance that some of them would even have been physically and sexually abused. It happened with white children, yeah, for sure. A deliberate kind of a genocidal policy? No, it wasn't. It was done in many cases with a genuine
Well, it's that old saying, isn't it? I mean, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. Yeah. And with stake, and we saw that with stake here on the side of the ditch as well. So, and often those are the things that are used, they're weaponized. to yes. actually to use to get a point across. Now, I want to pivot before we disappear this morning on to a piece that you wrote recently, because and it sort of ties in, because as you said, you're trying to wake people up. And one of the people that have been that's been really successful from a media perspective, because media has been exceptionally captured in the thrall of critical social justice and the likes of critical race theory et al., and that has been Tucker Carlson. And Tucker came to Australia recently, and you were able to see him. So how was that experience? I mean, seeing this guy who often many of us have watched on television screens, firstly in legacy media, and then now he's become probably one of the most successful independent broadcasters of our generation. How was that going to see somebody like him who is unashamedly American? He is about as patriot as you can get. He loves the United States. He's very vocal about it. He's completely unapologetic about it. As a Brit, feeling that same way about your Britishness, what was it like watching Tucker?
Well, I've forgiven the Americans now for their independence.
You've moved on. You've built a bridge.
I've moved on. I built a bridge. No, I love Tucker. I've always had a soft spot for Tucker. I think he's seeing him in the flesh and listening to him. I'm in media. I do the Richardson Post, which is, we have a good following for alternative media. We're probably one of the bigger ones in Australia. And even in that, you feel restraint, okay, in what you say. You learn quite quickly in media that a flippant offhand joke, we have a big comment section, and you can get fried in the, you've got to be very careful what you say, And the bigger you are, the more that comes in. I mean, the Richardson Post doesn't have a legal department, okay? I have to fly by the seat of my pants and rely on whatever sort of legal knowledge I have, which is pretty limited. But if you were working for a big media organization, of course they're going to have huge huge legal departments, and there's all these different, you got advertisers, you got producers, you got this and that, so you have to be very careful. Now, I always admired Tucker, and I always felt he was pushing the boundaries, and like you'll find most people in media know a lot more than they let on. Okay, but like you don't just jump on the mic. You get the odd one, like I think maybe Alex Jones or some people like that, who've been thrown into the wilderness to some extent. They seem to be coming back a little, but mostly people will be fairly. And again, Alex Jones, I think he's been sued, he's lost lost everything and so forth. It was the lady in England who's very outspoken, and she got sued and lost her house. It was very
famous. Katie Hopkins.
Katie Hopkins, yeah.
I've interviewed Katie.
Yeah, she's another great person, but she's very outspoken. Tucker's a lot more careful and circumspect, which I appreciate. I respect that. And I think it's actually a good thing, people take you more seriously when you're more nuanced, So and Tucker, I wrote a review that you mentioned before. I always had a feeling that he had a team of writers who were working together and producing, because to produce like a script every day, every day come out with one of these monologues, which are, probably around 1,000 or 1,500 word monologues. There's a bit of work in there and research and then writing it and smoothing it out and, proofreading it and everything like that. So I assumed he had a team, and he was reading a lot of it just from a teleprompter. But having seen him in the flesh, I think I'm sure he has researchers and the like, but a lot of what he does is from his own, off his own bat. He was very impressive. You would see in as you mentioned, the viral clippers, a bunch of idiotic journalists in Australia who's just embarrassing.
It just goes to your point about narcissism, I thought.
Yes. Yeah. They're like, don't you feel guilty because that white person went and killed a bunch of black people and he was like, what the hell are you talking about? I said, don't you think you've influenced him? What I say is for me to say. If someone's, it's just ridiculous what these people come up with. You're pro gun, and so you're responsible for these mass shootings. But Tucker is a powerhouse. He really is a powerhouse. He's so articulate. I'm so jealous of people who are that articulate. I write really well, and I don't mind blowing my horn on that, but I'm not articulate in the way he is. You know, people, if people came to me with all these, you know, what about this and what about this, they tie me up in knots. If I have an interview and it was really hostile, I'm like, but and afterwards I'll be thinking, oh, I should have said this, I should have said that. Like most people, you know, it's quite a rare talent to be able to really answer these people back. You need he's obviously done a lot of thinking. He's thought through things very well, and he's able to just pull these things out. You know, he's like got this huge memory bank they can just pull stuff out of. You know, it's like, and for me, I have to sit down for a couple of days and think about it, and it'll come back. Okay, it'll come to me. But being able to do it on the spot, like boomf, that's a skill that's fantastic. So yeah, really, I really like Tucker. I've always liked him. And I was really impressed by the thing. And I was lucky enough, I got really good seats. I was three rows back and right in front of him. So that was excellent. So yeah.
Oh, no, the review was brilliant. So as we wrap up, I mentioned before the two books, The Story of Muhammad and Anglophobia. If people are wanting to look up that work, Harry, and see where they can purchase, where are those available?
Well, if you go to BritishAustralianCommunity.com.au and scroll down a little bit and click on the book, there's a picture of Anglophobia there. You can go to Amazon. It's available on Amazon. You need to type in it. 35,000 copies later, you need to type the entire name in, and it comes out. It's the third book down when you search it up. It's like they're obviously, you know, like desperately trying to squash it. They've not gone as far as removing it, but it's also available in a number of different languages. It's in about seven different languages on Amazon. So if you can search it up on Amazon, might be an easy way. You can. Anglophobia, you can actually go into a bookshop, I believe, and get it because we publish it on Amazon, but also through a group called Ingram Spark who supply bookshops. So if you asked the bookshop and gave them the title, they would, which is Anglophobia, the Unrecognized Hatred, they should be able to order that in for you. Or Booktopia, I think, is usually fairly good. So they're
There's a
available
few
generally.
places.
If you email me, harryo@gmail.com, I could probably send it to you. Do a bank transfer and the postage wouldn't be too much. I think, yeah, the Story of Muhammad is only, I usually sell them for $10. The Anglophobia is, I think, so $22 plus postage. Yeah, those are ways again. You can also get Anglophobia through an audio book. If you go to the BAC, you go follow the links through there and you can get it as an audio book or as a Kindle. So any of those options. So yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Hey, look, I really appreciate you giving us your time this morning. This has been Harry Richardson. He's the writer, as we said before, The Story of Muhammad and Anglophobia, and the president of the British Australian Community. So thank you, Harry, for your time this morning, and go well.
Thank you so much for having me on, Marie. It's great for the chance to talk. See you then. Bye bye.
Don't disappear, of course. More here to come with Reality Check Radio Counterculture.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.